The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We want to get back in the discussion that we were where we were on Monday in the hour, having emphasized just previously the point, the ultimate unity or oneness of the covenant, the reality of the covenant. Now, its comprehensive character, and we had set a position for ourselves, as it were, between the positions of Professor Murray, wanting to exclude anything before the fall as covenant, and on the other hand, the position of Dumbrell, seeing a covenant as being made with creation in such a way that the focus on man as unique image bearer gets eclipsed. So right at that point, we can go on to say that in a general, as a general consideration, covenant and creation ought not then simply to be identified with each other, not simply equated. Two qualifications or amplifications of that we can bring in here right away. First of all, the creation of man in God's image is prior, logically prior, to the covenant relationship between God and man. A logical priority of creation to covenant. At the same time, as we make that statement, we want to be clear that Adam is not to be thought of as ever having existed even for a moment outside of this covenant relationship. So that, I'm just underlining that it's a logical priority. The Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 7, section 1, its statement of the covenant, makes reference there to the voluntary condescension of God to be in covenant with man. And the point then we're wanting to emphasize is that that is not to be, that voluntary condescension is not to be thought of coming into the picture at some point subsequent to creation, but is it occurs and is realized at the time of creation. So that the priority, the distinction to be made here is a logical one. At the same time, too, we can observe that covenant, understood now as the relationship between God and man established at creation in the beginning, covenant is the means by which God reaches the goal for creation. So the distinction can be expressed that way. Covenant is the means for reaching the goal for creation. But then immediately we must go on to say that in that goal, the covenant relationship in its consummate form is central. Covenant is the means to the end. Covenant is the means of reaching the goal, but in that goal, the covenant relationship, the consummate covenant relationship, is central. So that in this sense, covenant is both means and end. Covenant is both the means and the end, so far as God's purpose for creation is concerned. And really all that, you see, can be captured, even though we haven't worked at it carefully exegetically here, but perhaps you can. This will help to concretize what I've been saying for you right away. What we've been saying here can be captured in the Emmanuel, the Immanuel God with us, that Christ is. You see, that God with us is both the means to the end and the end itself. Yes. Well, I'm not sure that he ever really, I'm not sure that how he would respond or react to that. I think he would simply want to say again, he would probably want, well, I guess I shouldn't put it just that way. I think he would say that what this basic religious relationship, which I am calling covenant, he would not want to call covenant in terms of the reasons that I, factors that I indicated. All right, with those, observation, we can go on then and suggest this basic profile for things. Yes, B. That's what that's supposed to say. Little parenthetical B. Keeping in view what we were just underlining, the distinction between creation and covenant, and yet the inseparable bond between them. From the very first moment of existence on earth, man is set apart for covenant, taken up into a covenant relationship with God. But then, in time now, man sinned. And that is to say, we should be very clear on this, to say that man sinned is to say that he broke this relationship. He fractures the relationship. Now, when that happened, and when God responds, he does not abandon the covenant, but restores it. And what that meant, what that has meant, to say that he did not abandon the covenant, but restored it, that means that he has placed the covenant relationship on another foundation. And more specifically, he places the covenant on another foundation by linking the covenant to a new covenant head, by basing the covenant now upon the work of a new covenant head, the reconciling work that is demanded by sin. And that is to point us to the work of Christ. And we're going to talk more about that as we go on. But here we can simply content ourselves by observing that this development, which results in this radical break in the covenant relationship, the radical break in covenant relationship brought about by man's sin, and then the equally radical measures that are required of God and required by God to restore that relationship, and most particularly what is required, as we were just saying, is the radically new foundation to covenant provided by Christ. All that, of course, points us to the actual course of history. History as unfolding in two fundamental stages, if you will, two basic dispensations of the covenant. Covenant before the fall, covenant after the fall. The actual unfolding of covenant reality has a basic two-step profile to it. And this distinction and difference between the two is obviously crucial. We may not ignore or depreciate. We must maintain this distinction at all costs. The first stage in terms of creation, the original creation, we could refer to that as the covenant of creation, and the second subsequent stage of restoration, the covenant, if you will, then, of recreation or consummation. So I want to make that distinction here and be emphatic about it, and yet round off this discussion with this observation again, that despite this crucial distinction, or better, not despite, but just in view of this distinction, just in view of these important, irreducible differences, Together they form an indissoluble unity. Ultimately, we are dealing with two facets of one covenant, where the one stage is the outworking of the other, where the one is the means to the goal of the other. Which is to say, we are back to what we saw about the relationship, the way in which the work of Christ as last Adam is related to Adam in a passage particularly like 1 Corinthians 15 and Romans 5 as well. So, the covenant is one and comprehensive. Fifth, we set the stage for ourselves, and what we were just saying right at the end here, the basic twofold profile, a covenant before the fall, covenant after the fall, and that provides what we want to amplify if you're looking at the outline sheet, section D, covenant of creation, and section E, covenant of new creation. But before we go on to do that, address the actual unfolding of the covenant in history, there's one other structural matter that I think is appropriately taken up here, at least touched on here. It could come up at a later point, but I've felt it useful to bring it in here. And that is now, in effect, to address a question. And it is, in fact, a perennial, a much debated question. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I think you have to be very careful there, though. In terms of the decree and plan of God, there's a certain truth in what you're saying. But at the same time, you must be very careful that you do not build in then a defect into the original creation, as if it were necessary. As if Adam were bound to fall because he was lacking in something. Or because, in other words, you must not undermine the very good of Genesis 1:31. I think it's crucial to balance those two considerations off. Yes. Christ becomes necessary when Adam fails. Christ is not necessary until Adam fails. Now, I don't think we want to say that. Remember what we saw in 1 Corinthians 15, that there's an S, apparently, as we analyze verses 44 and 45, there is an eschatology in view for the creation from the very beginning. Adam was set in the creation with a mandate and an eschatological goal, which he, in fact, failed to achieve. He failed to live up to be the Adam that he was designed to be. And so a new Adam becomes necessary. Yes, because, and I think you can, its oneness can be seen in the fact that Christ achieves what Adam failed. Now, I just set the stage for a question that we want to address, and it's there on the outline sheet. Is the covenant unilateral or bilateral? Is the covenant unilateral or bilateral? And we might also bring in here as well a closely, maybe not exactly identical, but a closely parallel question. Is the covenant conditional or unconditional? Maybe to keep it parallel with unilateral or bilateral, is it unconditional or conditional? Now, in terms of our basic biblical idea of covenant, or as we can always make that concrete for ourselves, in terms of the Immanuel principle, the answer to that question is yes. It is both unilateral and bilateral. And that's what we need to think through now for a while, reflect on. So, a sequence of small sub-points. To begin with, If we focus on the origin and initiation that's involved in covenant, origin, initiation, covenant is plainly unilateral and unconditional. The covenant is unilateral, unconditional. Because the covenant relationship is not one of equality. It's not one, a relationship established between equals. God, you see, in covenant, God is the creator of man. And as such, he enters into covenant with man, his creature. And here it's important to maintain a certain balance, perhaps negotiate a thin line. It is certainly the case that man as created is uniquely the image bearer of God. And as such, as God's image, as he is made to be, man is created for fellowship with God. Man exists for fellowship with God. But as we say that, as we maintain that, we must not leave the suggestion, and here's where we have to be careful and be on guard that we don't fall into any this kind of thinking. We must not, though, when we say that man is created for fellowship with God, we must not think of the covenant relationship is a natural situation in which man finds himself, as it were, automatically or autonomously. That is, to put my concern here another way, we must not think that the situation is such so that by nature man is entitled to lay claim on God. Rather, what we have to take account of here is a fellowship bond established through God's sovereignty, through God's sovereign initiative, and the content of the relationship, the character of the relationship. That is not something up for grabs between God and man. It is not something that they negotiate between themselves. But the content and character is decided for and provided by God alone. So, as we've said, in these respects, in respect of the origin of the relationship, in respect of the initiative taken, the covenant is decidedly one-sided. Decidedly one-sided, unconditional, monergistic. Monergistic means working alone. Now we can perhaps reinforce this point, reflect on it just a bit along these lines. What we're concerned for here, the one-sidedness, the unilateral aspect of the whole matter, that is clearly reflected in the biblical language or the biblical usage of the words for covenant. The Hebrew, bereath. Bereath, though it can have the broader sense of a compact or an agreement, when it comes to divine covenant making, which is what we have our attention on here, when it comes to divine covenant making, the specific bereath has the specific sense of a determined arrangement, and in that sense, a disposition. Disposition in the sense of how things are disposed of. And it was this unilateral sense of bereath that eventually, when we come to the Septuagint, and then following the Septuagint, the New Testament writers themselves, it was this unilateral sense of bereath that Septuagint and New Testament grasp and tried to bring out when they invariably translate bereath by diatheke. And just commenting briefly now on the Greek term. As I said, employed first by the Septuagint and then by the New Testament to translate bereath. Now, in its origin, diatheke is a legal term, a term that refers to an arrangement or regulation that is made by one party such that the other party involved can only accept or reject. But otherwise, that second party has no say in the matter. So we find the term used especially for a testamentary arrangement, a last will. Diatheke in the sense of a last will and testament. Although in this particular testamentary sense, in the sense of a last will, it appears in that specific sense, it occurs in the New Testament. Apparently, this can be debated, but I think at least the only clear instance would be Hebrews 9, 16, and 17, where the death of Christ is seen as having a testamentary significance. Now, what's interesting here and reinforces is that the unilateral force of things that we're trying to bring out in Diatheke and in Bereath and Diatheke, that is reinforced by the fact that Septuagint and the New Testament following the Septuagint constantly avoided the term Suntheke, which was at their disposal. They consciously avoided that term as a translation for Bereath. And this, the word Suntheke, as you can perhaps see from the prepositional prefix, that carries with it connotations of equality, that the parties involved are on a par. And the term then has the sense of a compact or a contract mutually arrived at. But as we're saying, when things get into the Greek language domain, Septuagint and New Testament, that term is avoided. So that enables us to reinforce the point that the covenant is not, as the children's catechism that I was taught and memorized in answer to the question, what is a covenant? A covenant is not, quote, an agreement between two or more persons. And it is then, I guess you could say, a continuing liability of the English word covenant. A continual liability here is that its ordinary, everyday usage, what we could, I guess, call its secular usage, as employed by lawyers and so on, it does there refer to a contract, a mutually arrived at and agreed upon contract. And that sense of the word is tied up with its derivation out of the Middle English through the Old French, eventually back to the Latin, convenio, to come together and to agree. That's where our English word covenant comes from. Now, I don't think this is that big a problem, because what I've referred to as the ordinary use of the term or secular use of the word covenant is fairly extraordinary for most of us. Ask yourself, how many times have you talked about covenant other than in your study of the scriptures and theology? So that the language, I think, it is more and more, the term is more and more defined for us as we see it as an almost exclusively biblical and theological category. But in a respect, covenant just is a, as it at least enters into a process of semantic change, a covenant as it originally functioned is a very inadequate vehicle for conveying the idea that's intended. It's difficult to find another English term. Probably the best rendering would be disposition. disposition, if you want to get really technical about it. So, unilateral, without doubt. Now, second, when we focus in on what we have referred to as our basic idea, that is, the relationship involved, the fellowship bond, then we come to appreciate now that covenant is decidedly two-sided and bilateral. The bilateral is involved. In the abstract, that would not... in the abstract, a religious relationship would not necessarily have to be bilateral, but that would certainly be an abstraction so far as Scripture is concerned. In Scripture, the religious is always mutual, involves mutuality. So when we say that the covenant is bilateral, we mean that not merely in the sense that God established covenant with man as a second party, but we mean that it is bilateral also in terms of the content, the substance of the relationship. And as we can capture that content now for ourselves in a preliminary way by saying the content of the covenant always involves certain promises of God to man and certain obligations before God for man. The mutuality, the bilateral, comes into view as we see that the content of covenant always involves promises and obligations. You see, in covenant with God, man is not passive, but active. Active to a high degree. The situation is such that man must accept God's promises. He must obey God's commands. He must live always, coram Deo, in the face of God. And all this is simply to say, at root, the covenant involves that man must believe God. He must trust God. As that trust is both active and passive, as that trust is both resting and restless. So here we come upon what is essential to the covenant, and that is the principle of faith, essential to the covenant seen from the side of man. Covenant and faith cannot be separated. Or as we could reflect on it, perhaps in more a more modern, if that's the right word, idiom. The covenant is a personal bond. It's a bond between persons. It's an intersubjective relationship. A bond between persons. In that respect, an intersubjective relationship. Now, almost everybody would want to accent that today. And here we must distance ourselves, in what we've just said, we must distance ourselves immediately from a great deal of contemporary theologizing. To say that the covenant is an intersubjective relationship involves that at the same time we make clear that in that bond, as God enters into that relationship, he does not compromise himself. God does not, for the sake of covenant, surrender some of his attributes. Just to the contrary. On the contrary, just as he is God of the covenant, we're told, Isaiah 55, 8 and 9. Just as he is the God of the covenant, his ways and thoughts are high above ours, as heaven is higher than earth. So God does not give up something to be in covenant. And yet at the same time, we can say that in covenant with man, God, as it were, respects his person. God respects his person. And by that I mean to say that in covenant with man, God in no way does God impair our creaturely sovereignty, our creaturely sovereignty and capacities. In no way does he compromise the integrity of our persons. Or as it has been put in older theology, going back to Calvin, he does not deal with man like a stick or stone. Stock and block, as the Dutch say. Does not deal, in other words, with his image bearer as an inanimate object. Now, the interpersonal dimension of covenant that we're wanting to draw attention to here, that can be seen, taken in, and impress itself on us simply by glancing at the verbs used in Scripture, the verbs in Scripture that describe the action of God on the one hand, man on the other, in terms of covenant. And I'll just list these very quickly, highlighting the verb involved. Genesis 16:6-18, God establishes or makes covenant. Dumbrell, as you may recall, prefers to render that God confirms the covenant. 9:15 of Genesis, he remembers the covenant. Deuteronomy 7:19, he keeps the covenant. Ezekiel 16:8, he enters into covenant. Ezekiel 20:37 says he brings Israel into a covenant bond. He brings Israel into covenant bond. Correlatively then, from the side of man, and these are passages that are where Israel is in view without, pretty much without exception, man then is said to act in accord with the covenant, Israel, in 2 Chronicles 34:32. As God, so man keeps covenant. Psalm 103:18. And these, of course, you know, some of these are found in a number of times, number of currents. He holds fast the covenant. Isaiah 56:4-6. Or looking then on the dark side, he transgresses or acts in violation of the covenant. Deuteronomy 17:2. He abandons the covenant. Deuteronomy 29:25. He breaks. 31:16. He rejects. 2 Kings 17:15. He is unfaithful to, does not persevere in the covenant. Psalm 73:37. Yes.
Other problem with the
break. Yes, very definitely. Well, I think what's lying in back. That's how do I answer that in intelligibly? So I think what Moltmann will have nothing to do with is any kind of distinction between what Dr. Van Til or others would call ontological and economic trinity. God is constantly finding himself. God needs the cross to become the trinity. So you can't really be, God will actually, in fact, God is in the process of becoming the trinity at the end of history. So any idea of a sovereign, self-sufficient God, well, the aseity of God is something that Moltmann will have nothing to do.
There's not a pre-existing existence.
Yes. Right. It's on the way to realization.
Well.
Yes.
In order to find himself.
He'd love to hear you say that. Right.
And so the resurrection itself.
Yes. Right.
Okay. Now,
yes.
What is the God of man?
Yeah, I think the passage in Philippians 2, which talks about Christ being in the form of God, became man, form of a servant, I think Warfield has captured it so neatly. Thinking particularly of the verse he literally translated, he emptied himself and became of no reputation. Well, the way Warfield puts it there, he emptied himself by adding. See, being from all eternity and continuing to be fully God with all that that means, from all eternity in full aseity, became fully human. But see, you can see actually the point that I was making earlier that you picked up on, that can be focused in the incarnation. For Christ to be incarnate involved no kenosis. That is, there's no place for so-called kenotic theory, picking up on that idea of emptying in Philippians 2. He does not surrender in any respect his deity when he becomes fully man.
So the kenosis,
right.
Rather than the incarnation.
Yes.
Okay, now,
it's his humiliating himself.
Just going one step.
I think that is just that's an awesome thing. But you see, even in that moment, I think what you can't lose sight of, in that moment of abandonment and the obvious sense of abandonment that is being expressed there, it is my God that he calls out to. Yes. Yes. That's right. But which he has, which he completely distorts because of the philosophical, the thoroughly unbiblical philosophical model that I believe he comes at things. All right, so we were looking at these verbs to reflect, as they reflect in many different ways, the involvement on both sides, the mutuality. So really the only point I'm wanting to underline there a bit. So we could go on and say that in the covenant relationship that God establishes, God makes use of what he has given to man when he created him in his image, created him as his image. As the covenant relationship continues, God makes use. He does not abuse or forget or violate. And that's true even after the fall. God makes use of what has been given to man as image bearer. So we could say, as someone has put it, what was good at creation was also good for the covenant, those capacities as image bearers. And that is true even when subsequently just those capacities are used against God to break the covenant. And along this line, continuing just a bit further, bringing out, reflecting on the bilateral character of covenant. As God honors the integrity of our creatureliness, and as he gives full scope then to the active involvement that means, man is not, in all that, man then is not to be thought of as somehow self-reliant. When I say that God respects our creaturely integrity as image bearers, that does not mean that God then gives us a measure of independence from himself. Particularly, it does not mean, when we talk about God respecting our integrity, it does not mean that he gives us independence in the sense that we are somehow able to make a contribution to the covenant relationship. As if somehow of ourselves now, apart from God, we are able to constitute the covenant. You see, what we're talking about here, what we're warning against at this point, is what is at the root of all of the Pelagian and Arminian tendencies that have come into theology. So when we talk about mutuality And the bilateral and creaturely integrity, we are not, that must not be understood or taken in the sense of any, in any tendency towards some sort of autonomy, however minimal. Must not be taken and pushed in the direction that figures such as Pelagius and Arminius did. So, as we could say it, to use another term, I guess I haven't put it this way yet. Certainly the covenant is a reciprocal relationship. Nice word, reciprocity. The covenant is certainly that, a reciprocal relationship. But what is preserved by this relationship is not some measure of autonomy, however slight, however little bit of a sliver we think we might be able to get in there. What is preserved is not autonomy, but creaturely integrity. Underline creaturely. Because to speak of creaturely integrity is to speak of the integrity I have as radically, absolutely dependent on my Creator. The integrity we are concerned for wanting to maintain there is the integrity that comes from knowing myself to be absolutely, radically dependent on God. So that we are talking then about a reciprocity where to be able to do what he has asked to do, for him to be able to act as he is required to act, man as creature remains totally dependent on God. And that is true before as well as after the fall, though in a different mode, in a different way after the fall than before the fall, as we'll be going on to see. So we could really try to focus everything, if it's helpful at this point, by saying that the bilateral that we're talking here about here is a function of the unilateral. The bilateral is a result of divine monergism. And we could sum up to this point by saying then that the covenant is unilateral in origin and initiation and consummation. It is bilateral in its content and outworking. Unilateral in origin, initiation, and consummation. In other words, unilateral from beginning to end, bilateral in its actual content and outworking. So with that, A, B, we come to C under this point of unilateral, bilateral. Let's wait until after the break to pick up on that.